Two aspects shouted at me as I prepared with the text this week. One is the call to cross the flooded river to reach the land of promise, and the other is the call to a deep integrity. And so I began with these two very different notions, both so significant, but wondering how they might be connected. I turned firstly to the Old Testament story from Joshua, where the people crossed that flooded Jordan River in order to finally enter the promised land after all those long 40 years in the wilderness. It is yet another pivotal point in the life of the people of Israel. The 40 years in the wilderness is nearly over. They stand at the brink of the promised land. But this is a very different people from 40 years earlier. Imagine how many people have died and were buried in the wilderness, and how many have been born in those years of wandering. Here stands the sons and daughters, the grandsons and granddaughters of those who left Egypt. But here at the end, like at the beginning, the people stand before a body of water that they cannot pass. This time it's the Jordan River, flowing fast and full from the harvest rains. Again, they need a miracle from God, and God intervenes. God tells Joshua to have the 12 priests, each representing a tribe of Israel, to carry the Ark of the Covenant into the water. Following on from someone is not always easy, whatever the job or role. It's not that the predecessor tried to make it difficult for the one who follows them. It's just that people remember them and the way they did things. And the better they did them, the harder it is for their successor to then do things their own way. Especially as over time the memory of the predecessor starts to become more myth than reality. And so we have Joshua filling the rather large shoes of Moses. It's a hard act to follow. And in these large shoes, he arrives at the flooded Jordan River. But what matters most is that God, just as he was with Moses, is also with Joshua. Joshua was never going to be a Moses, but he could be the best Joshua he could. Joshua brings the people to the banks of the Jordan River, a river which today is much tamer due to all the extensive irrigation schemes now drawing water from there. But this was a river that, although not the size of the Tigris or the Euphrates, in the springtime when the snows of Mount Hermon melted, became this raging and impassable torrent. It would regularly flood its banks in those weeks. Think about it. Joshua leads the people to the Jordan in the flood season. He leads this huge army of men, followed by thousands of women and children, to the edge of the promised land, with the River Jordan now forming this formidable barrier. Surely it was the wrong time to cross. Unless God wanted to be the waymaker, the miracle worker. And that's what happened. As the chosen priests carried the sacred Ark of the Covenant, which represented the very presence of God in their midst, into the shallows of the river, facing that impassable torrent before them, the river stops flowing. The tribes of Hebrews were able to walk across the dry riverbed to the land flowing with milk and honey. Just as Moses had led the people through the Red Sea at the start of the Exodus, now Joshua would lead them through the waters of the Jordan at the end. It's interesting to note that during World War I, a British officer was leading his troops in that Jordan region without support of army engineers, and he also came to the River Jordan and wondered how they would ever cross it. An Arab guide told him to just wait at the riverbank, stay undercover and be patient. After a few frustrating days, the river finally stopped flowing for almost an hour and the soldiers were able to cross. The Arab guide knew about the phenomenon, but couldn't predict the timing. What actually happens is that early in the spring season, as the water starts to flow more strongly, at times the current erodes the cliffs near Galilee, causing the landfall, which then stops the flow of the water for a period of time. But that is not to say that this was not a miracle, because Joshua would also have not been able to pick the time of such an occurrence. What we see is that God was faithful, and ensured that they could cross the Jordan at just the right time. It is a remarkable story, and one that speaks to our own experience of entering fearful places in order to reach the fulfillment of promise. It reminds us that God's presence in the midst of raging torrents empowers us to enter those places too. And that is where miracles happen, when faithful people are led by God into the difficult and scary places in need of a way forward. When in humble obedience we follow God through the hard places to the longed for place of promise. A step of faith into fearful waters, and God is there with them. It's a story of transition, full of hope and fear. Hope in the way God has led them out of slavery, but also fear in that they're heading into an already occupied land as immigrants. This crossing of the Jordan River, from the old to the new, from slavery to freedom, from complaint to praise, is not something that we can take lightly. We all find ourselves in wildernesses at times when the only way to get out is to courageously face raging waters and trust that God will be there. It may feel like the timing is all wrong, and yet somehow God has led us to this place. We come to a river where there is no bridge, no sure or safe way to cross, a roadblock, and we have to be willing to step into the flooded waters before God acts. When do you feel stuck on the wrong side of God's promises? What are the times when the waters seem too high for you to cross? As you reflect on the river you or others are facing at the moment, those hard things ahead of you, ask yourself, where do you find yourself in this story? Are you called to lead the way and hold God's presence for others as they cross? Or is there someone else who is doing that for you, and you have to have the courage to join them on the way? Then I turn to the gospel reading. Remember the context. First, the Herodians tried to trap Jesus about taxes, then the Sadducees about the resurrection, and then the Pharisees about the law. And Jesus then questioned them about the Messiah's identity, a political son of David figure or the son of God. And then we read Jesus getting really tough with the Pharisees. The hypocrisy Jesus is calling them out on is about the burdens they're placing on others and yet unwilling to carry themselves. The way they behave in order to be recognised, with their broad phylacteries and long tassels. The phylacteries are those boxes worn on their foreheads that carried particular scriptures, an obvious declaration that they were following the law. And the long fringes with their beautiful blue tassels tied to the four corners of their garments that were meant to be this constant reminder of God's commandments. The way they sought the best seats, both at the parties and at the synagogue, wanting seats of honour at banquets and wanting to sit on Moses' seat, a seat of honour in the synagogue that was close to the arch where the scrolls of the Torah were kept. Whoever sat there was recognised as having the authority to teach. Jesus is calling them out on their hypocrisy. So I turn to the word hypocrite. It's an interesting one. It comes from the Greek word Hippocrates, meaning an actor or a stage player. It literally translates as an interpreter from underneath, which reflects the ancient Greek actors wearing their masks, and the actor would speak from underneath the mask. Eventually, the Greek word evolved to refer to any person who was wearing a figurative mask and pretending to be someone or something they were not. A person who is acting, not participating in reality, that is a hypocrite. Jesus is calling us to step off the stage, to recognise that this is the real world and we're not performing for an audience. What matters is that our words match the rest of us. So here we are with these two texts, a raging river to cross and a call against hypocrisy, and I continue to explore the connection. I stood at the edge of a river in my mind and I imagined what it took for those 12 priests to wade into the water with their load. I imagined their willingness to obey the call of God into that fearful place so that the whole people could reach the land of promise. And I reflected on the way that each step we take into the river as the waters swirl around our ankles and make our hearts sink in fear has to be a step of integrity. There is no room in this place of danger for hypocrisy. This is no acting a role in order to find a claim and honour. This is real waters that might still overcome us. This is the place where we must be willing to carry the load for another, perhaps even carry the presence of God for another, so they too will reach the promised land. This is the moment when what we believe in our heads and hearts must become enfleshed in our actions, to be willing to step into the waters, trusting that God is in our midst and will make a way for us to reach the other side. That is integrity, the opposite of hypocrisy, and for me that is crucial to Christian faith. It means what you see is what you get. It means doing the work so that under the first layer, it's still you. We often use the image of peeling back the layers of the onion, but what I like about the onion is that each layer is still onion. You don't pull back a couple of layers and find a lemon. That is integrity. When our actions speak the same message as what comes out of our mouths, when we do the right thing even when no one is looking, even when it's as basic as putting the shopping trolley back in the supermarket car park, because that is who we are all the way through. So go back to the image of standing at the Jordan River. Know the humble integrity it takes to wade into the waters, the servant heart that's required. There is no longer space for pretense. The real you, fully you, must enter the river, or not. I wonder what it will be. Amen.